From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A Palestinian grand jury resister is finally released after months shackled to a bed. Today on Democracy Now!, Abdul Halim Ashkar is free after 6 months in detention for refusing to answer questions about Hamas. He'll join us with a lawyer who says this is happening all too often in the USA. Plus, two countries in a struggle to build democracy. We'll have reports from Indonesia and an update from Amy Goodman in Nigeria. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! Here on Pacifica Radio. I'm Laura Flanders. No, I'm not Amy Goodman. She is still on assignment. We're going to hear from her later on in the program from where she is now in Lagos, Nigeria. We've got a lot on the program today, but let's start with some news updates on a story that we covered a few weeks back. As many Democracy Now! Listeners may recall, California law enforcement came down hard on environmentalists in Humboldt County last fall. Officers applied pepper spray directly to the eyes of protesters as they staged sit-ins at a lumber company and a congressman's office in and around the Headwaters Forest in California. Perhaps you remember the pictures on TV. Environmentalists screamed with pain as officers used cotton swabs to daub acid tear gas directly onto their eyeballs. The environmentalists say the authorities' actions amounted to torture and certainly undue force was used. And for the last 3 weeks, their case against local police and sheriffs, charging as much, has been being heard in federal court in San Francisco. What's at stake, they say, is the use of pepper spray in any nonviolent situation. Yesterday, Judge Vaughn R. Walker, who'd been overseeing the case, declared a mistrial after the jury deadlocked. With us on the line from California is Macon Cowles, lead co-counsel for the plaintiffs. He's going to be with us in just a moment. You're listening to Democracy Now! A little chaos here at Democracy Now! One thing I forgot to do, of course, was read you the headlines. So let's start with a few headlines here before we get into the pepper spray story. I've been reading them over here and thought I'd said them, so there you go. U.S. officials say the links that tie suspected terrorist Osama bin Laden to a Sudanese pharmaceutical plant are what they're calling fuzzy. President Clinton ordered cruise missile strikes against the factory, saying U.S. officials believe it was making chemical weapons. But a U.S. intelligence official now says intelligence reports show the plant is more connected to Iraq's chemical weapons program. U.S. officials say intelligence indicates scientists in Baghdad worked with counterparts at the plant on a formula for making deadly nerve gas. And sources say there's no direct financial relationship between the plant and bin Laden, who's suspected of orchestrating the U.S. embassy bombings in Africa. The U.S. has been under increasing pressure to explain just why the attack on the plant was made. The plant's known for making painkillers and malaria drugs. Meanwhile, a bomb exploded inside a Planet Hollywood restaurant in Cape Town today, killing one person and injuring 24. A man claiming responsibility for Tuesday's blast in South Africa's legislative capital said it was revenge for those U.S. attacks on targets in Sudan and Afghanistan. The caller to the radio station Cape Talk claimed to represent a group called Muslims Against Global Oppression. But a spokesperson for the organization, in comments to South African Broadcasting Corporation, denied it was involved. Police cordoned off the restaurant in the trendy Victoria and Albert waterfront and reinforced the situation with armored cars today. The indictment of 7 Cuban Americans for plotting to kill Fidel Castro is a serious blow to one of the most influential and best-organized Cuban exile groups in the U.S. The accusations Tuesday from a federal grand jury, including charges against a director of the Cuban-American National Foundation, come as Castro is being wooed by neighbors and other nations amid mounting global opposition to Washington's Cuba embargo. Despite numerous plots to kill Castro since his 1959 takeover, the indictment was believed to be the first such accusation in a court of law. The indictment alleges the defendants planned for 4 years to kill the 72-year-old Castro, in particular during his trip to a Latin American summit on Margarita Island off Venezuela in November of 97. The first named defendant is José Antonio Llama, a Miami businessman and director of the Miami-based Cuban American National Foundation, which Castro has long accused of trying to kill him. Llama's indictment is one of a series of setbacks for the foundation. Its well-known chairman, Jorge Mascanosa, died last November. Mas, who enjoyed White House access to Presidents Reagan, Bush, and Clinton, was seen as the man principally responsible for the hardline U.S. policies towards Cuba. With his ability to raise campaign funds, he was able to maintain a formidable influence over members of Congress, and it's an influence his foundation is now struggling to maintain. South African analysts and intelligence sources said rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo were still holding their western base at Matadi on Wednesday, but had come under heavy fire in the eastern stronghold of Kisangani. Angolan radio reports said troops sent by Luanda to help Congo President Laurent Kabila fight off a Tutsi-led rebellion had crossed the Congo River from the northwest and had taken Matadi, but South African intelligence sources, who declined to be named, said they'd no evidence to support that claim and believed it probably wasn't true. You're listening to Democracy Now! Having heard those snippets of headlines, we will move to that segment that I was so eager to get to before, namely the update of the situation in San Francisco, where a federal court has been hearing the case brought by environmentalists against local police and sheriffs charging torture and undue use of force in the pepper spray situation in Humboldt County last fall. Yesterday, Judge Vaughn R. Walker, as I said, who'd been overseeing the case, declared a mistrial after the jury deadlocked. And we're going to go now to Macon Cowles, lead co-counsel for the plaintiffs. Tell us, Mr. Cowles, exactly what did happen in court there in San Francisco yesterday. Are you there, Mr. Cowles? Are you there, Mr. Cowles?
I am. Cowles.
Cowles, tell us what happened there yesterday in court.
What happened yesterday was we got a mistrial.
The head of the jury came in rather tentative, was she, and explained that there'd been a problem?
No, after the vote was taken and the jury discharged, am I in the air right
yes,
now?
Yes, you are.
Okay. When the jury came in after deliberating for a period of hours, they simply said they can't reach an agreement. They were deadlocked 4-4.
Did you get any sense of what they were deadlocked over?
Yeah, they were deadlocked over whether or not this would be characterized as excessive force. And as the jury foreperson spoke to the press, she spoke about one person in particular who said that if people had come on my private property, I'd get a gun to run them off. And she also said that if a bomb had gone off in this guy's lap, he wouldn't have changed his vote on the thing. So, you know, what's apparent to us is that during jury selection, which is a process where the judge questions the jury to try to find out what their biases and prejudices are, we had at least one person who was an extremist that got by that selection process.
But presumably, I mean, just as a layperson here, I would have assumed that a judge could put a jury person straight on a matter of law, for example, the matter of whether a landowner is entitled to kill or shoot at with that kind of intention, a trespasser.
Well, there are all kinds of, I mean, you can imagine all kinds of additional instructions that could be given that could end up just clouding the issue for the jury, because really it was a very simple one. The question that was put to them is whether or not this was force in excess of that which would be used by a reasonable and prudent law enforcement officer under the circumstances. So the question was not a difficult one, but I guess what you realize is that people who see this video clip, it's almost like a great divide issue. They fall on one side of it or the other. And you know, the private property advocates can narrowly focus this issue and say, well, you know, if people are coming on private property, then the police can use any force, apparently, to get them off of there. There are other people, of course, our side of the case, who look at this and say, this is the same type of tactic that was used by law enforcement in the civil rights era as cattle prods and water hoses and barking angry dogs at no longer are used because they're simply viewed as not acceptable in a civilized society.
What is at stake here by way of in the future? When we had some guests from this case on the program Democracy Now! A few weeks back, they talked about their concern that the use of pepper spray continue and their hope, their wish that their court put an end to that, their trial put an end to that, their case. What is at stake now? What is due to take place in the next few weeks before there can be a retrial in which we may see this sort of tactic used again?
Well, I doubt that police, in at least in Humboldt County, are going to use this between now and the retrial of this case, because it certainly looks bad for them. Because one of the very important law enforcement issues is this: it is law enforcement can't afford to use a tactic which is going to alienate a substantial number of people in their constituency, in their service group, and this has created the use of pepper spray, directly applying it to people's eyes, and then spraying it in this violent way that they did, jerking people's heads back, and then applying pepper spray at point-blank distance. This has caused a firestorm in Humboldt County and in the service area of the sheriff and the police department up there. And so, you know, the truth is that law enforcement can't afford to use this kind of a tactic when it so outrages a substantial number of people who live there and rely on them to provide services.
When do you expect the retrial?
It's going to be on November 16th.
Well, we look forward to hearing how it shapes up then, and perhaps you'll have some opportunity to talk to media about this situation. Particularly, understand there's going to be another Headwaters Forest protest in early September, when one would hope that people would be on alert for tactics used against protesters.
Right. The protest season starts again mid-September at the end of the marbled murrelet nesting season.
Macon Coles is lead co-counsel for the plaintiffs. That decision out of California came down yesterday when a judge declared a mistrial after the jury deadlocked. In just a moment, we're going to follow up on another story covered here on Democracy Now! Stay tuned. After 6 months in detention, grand jury resister Dr. Abdul Halim Ashkar is free. Perhaps you remember the story. In late February, Dr. Ashkar, a visiting Palestinian academic, was called before a federal grand jury in New York. The grand jury was reportedly investigating a U.S.-based fundraising operation for Hamas, the Palestinian organization. Dr. Ashkar isn't a member of Hamas, and he wasn't charged with any crime, but he did refuse to answer any of the grand jury's questions on principle, saying he would rather die than give information that could be used against his friends or relatives. A judge then sent him off to jail for contempt of the grand jury, and there Dr. Ashkar immediately went on hunger strike. The court ordered Dr. Ashkar to be force-fed, and the last time we discussed this case on this program, Dr. Ashkar was in fact shackled to a bed in a jail ward at a 45-degree angle with a tube forcing food into his nose. Well, this is a pretty gruesome story, and it's not an isolated incident. The specifics of Dr. Ashkar's situation may be particular, but the use of the grand jury as an information-gathering device is certainly not exclusive in this case. We have with us, we're honored to have Dr. Abdul Halim Ashkar with us on the line. Dr. Ashkar, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much.
We also have your lawyer, Abdin Jabara, who's an attorney who sits on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights and is a former president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Abdin Jabara, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's go first to Dr. Ashkar. How did your release come about?
The federal court in Manhattan held a hearing last Monday in August 17th, and the judge ordered me released last Friday, 21st of August.
What was the first you knew that you were about to be released?
Sorry?
What was the first you knew? How did you get let know? You know, how were you told? What was your experience that day?
Well, the head of Marshall's and my attending physician came to my room and said, "You are released." Honestly, I didn't expect that, but although it came late, but I was very happy.
Obviously, the question everybody wants to know is the state of your health after these 5 months of hunger strike and force feeding. What condition are you in physically? Have you been able to be examined at this point?
Yeah, I so many doctors since my release. I lost too much weight, almost 55 pounds. Still, I can't eat. I take some juices, yogurt, jello, things like that. That would continue for 2 weeks. After that, I might be able to eat normally. I'm having some back pain before that has deteriorated sharply since my incarceration and lack of care for my back. Other than that, I think I am pretty fine.
We've spoken on this program in your absence about your motivation in refusing to answer the grand jury's questions. Now that we have you with us on the line in person, can you tell us in your own words why it was that you decided not to cooperate with the grand jury?
Actually, for a variety of reasons. First of all, I think that Israel stands behind this investigation. Therefore, I cannot be part of any attempt to serve the occupier of my homeland. This is the first thing, and it's very obvious. I was told by the U.S. attorney a long time ago, since September 96, before I was subpoenaed to appear in front of a grand jury, I was told by the U.S. attorney in Mississippi that we need your help to build cases to incriminate others, or you'll be subpoenaed to appear in front of a grand jury in South District of New York. And you know that this the U.S. Attorney Office there and FBI are dominated by pro-Israelis.
Why do you believe that the officials came to you?
Actually, since 1991, I have been subject to harassment by both FBI and U.S. Attorney in Mississippi. And in different occasions, they told the University of Mississippi, in which I was a student since 1990, they told them in different occasions that the Israelis brought their attention to me and told them about me. And I was told, too, in more than one occasion. In 1994, for instance, October 1994, I was interviewed by FBI, and I was told that we are interviewing you on behalf of the Israeli government.
Again, though, why? Do you have any connection to Hamas, the organization?
No, I didn't have. Before I came to the States, I was the director of public relations department at the Islamic University of Gaza. And I was known well to the Israelis. That before I came. Second, I established a fund, charitable fund to support education under occupation, called Al-Aqsa Educational Fund, non-profit organization, tax-exempt fund. And I donated some books and some money to the academic institutions in the occupied territories.
We're going to take a break for 60 seconds and come right back to find out more about Abdul Halim Ashkar's case and what it may have to do with you. You're listening to Democracy Now. You're listening to Democracy Now!, sitting in for Amy Goodman. I'm Laura Flanders. We're talking about grand jury resistors. And, well, now we're going to talk about secret evidence and the kind of evidence that is used that defendants never get to find out about, exactly why they're being detained, why they're being investigated. You've just heard Dr. Abdul Halim Ashgar, a Palestinian academic who has been in jail for 6 months under just deplorable conditions, just ending a hunger strike, just released. We're going to talk now about what his case may have to do with the rest of us. With us in the studio is Abdin Jabara, an attorney on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Answer that question, Abdin. It sounds like an outrageous case, a horrific story, but a personal one. What has it got to do with the rest of us?
Well, number one, the fact of the matter is that over the past several years, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Attorney General and the FBI have targeted Arabs and Muslims around the United States for special procedures and prosecutions to infringe on associational rights, number one, the support, legal, lawful, humanitarian support.
The kind of thing that Dr. Ashgar just described.
Exactly, for foreign organizations. Many people in this country have ties with relatives and families and friends and charities overseas, and this type of thing has been targeted by the U.S. attorney and under this new anti-terrorism law passed in April of 1996. Now, but the other aspect of what has been happening is that there are now 14 cases around the United States involving various people who are all Muslim or Arab, where they are being subjected to deportation proceedings on the basis of secret evidence. That is, evidence that neither they nor their lawyers can see. This involves a client of mine, an Egyptian, who has been in detention and segregated, administrative segregation for over 2.5 years without any charge whatsoever, just merely violating his immigration status. It involves 2 Algerians. It involves 6 Iraqis that were brought here by the United States government who had worked with the CIA in northern Iraq. And it involves 3 Palestinians, one of whom is in Newark, New Jersey, and incarcerated. All of these people are under incarceration, detention, except one. Individual in Detroit is not incarcerated. And what the government is doing is coming in and saying, look, we're going to give something to the judge here for the judge to look at or to listen to, and you're not going to get to see it. Mm. You're not going to get to respond to that. The only thing that they receive is a truncated summary of allegations that is not evidence at all.
Sounds like the secret evidence sort of. We've been talking a lot about secret evidence this week, kind of like the secret evidence used to explain the bombing of Khartoum pharmaceutical plants. Is there a relationship, do you think, between this kind of situation in the U.S. and this increasing aggression abroad? We saw an op-ed piece just 2 days ago from Stephen Emerson, someone you're very familiar with, calling for more serious clampdown on funding and support of international, quote-unquote, terrorist organizations in the United States.
Well, yes, I think that there is a very definite right-wing movement here in the United States to push for violation of basic constitutional rights, rights that have been enshrined, the rights of due process, the rights, First Amendment rights of association. If we take just the case of the Los Angeles 8.
The Iraqis.
No, not the Iraqis. This is a case of the Palestinians and one Kenyan. That case is now 12 years in the courts. 12 years in the courts. And the Justice Department, the Attorney General's office, they keep losing in the courts. and they keep seeking appeals, keep, and this has completely caused a tremendous draining of energy and resources and so forth, because you have to respond, you have to fight these charges. And of course, the government has unlimited resources at their disposal. And they're using this in a way that I'm amazed. I attended a convention recently in Washington, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee convention, and Janet Reno was a keynote speaker. And she got up and she essentially apologized. She said that the Arab and Muslim community in the United States had not been treated fairly by the Justice Department, and that she intended to look into this and see that it'd be changed. But I don't see any change happening. They're continuing to use the secret evidence. They're continuing the unlawful attempts to deny the California 8 residency in this country based on a very selective prosecution and the exercise of their First Amendment rights. What were they doing? Hmm. All they said that they were doing were distributing some magazines.
Hmm. Coming back to you, Dr. Abdulhalim Ashkar, the last word really to you. What do you say to those in the Justice Department and the FBI who say, well, we're engaged in a war against terrorism. We have to use very firm means and every means at our disposal to try to protect civilian lives?
Well, I think it's time to stop the witch hunt, the campaign against our community. We have not been involved in any illegal activity. We'll continue to support our cause because we think it's a cause of justice, freedom, and equality. We will not be, we will not refrain from supporting our cause regardless of the price that we are going to pay. Therefore, I think it's time to stop that and treat us fairly. We condemned any illegal activity here. If we did that, if we did any illegal activity, press charges and put us on a trial.
Dr. Abdulhalim Ashkar is a Palestinian academic, free now after 6 months in jail under deplorable conditions for refusing to cooperate with a grand jury. With us also has been Abdin Jabara, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and former president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Not Dr. Ashkar's lawyer, but an attorney representing several other defendants in a situation similar to Dr. Ashkar's, who is now free. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Nigeria's Electoral Commission on Tuesday announced that February 27th of next year, 1999, is to be the date for presidential elections, which they say will end years of military rule in the West African country, that is, Nigeria. We have with us on the line Amy Goodman to discuss some of these developments. Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now! From the other end of the phone, how are things in, where are you, Lagos?
Yes, I'm in Lagos, Nigeria, Laura, and very interesting what is happening here today. On the one hand, you have a trip that the military ruler of Nigeria has just completed to South Africa, being hailed by Nelson Mandela as a man who can bring democratic change to Nigeria. You see the elections being announced for February 27th with an ultimate handover of military power to civilian rule for the end of May. But the question is this truly a democratic transition? And this is the question that Nigerians across this largest country in Africa are grappling with. Some are organizing political parties. I just went to a meeting today of the G34. This is a group that's named for 34 past politicians. Yes, politicians under military rule and politicians who served in civilian governments who right at the end of the Abacha reign, right before he died, sent a letter to the president, to the dictator, Sonny Abacha, telling him he should not be succeeding himself. I don't know if people remember, before Sonny Abacha died, at first there was going to be a so-called transition to civilian rule, but then he announced he would be the only candidate running. In fact, even President Clinton said that if he ran as a civilian, the U.S. would support him. That's a little difficult to believe, that you can change from being a military man to a civilian. I guess it's just called changing your clothes. But at this time, it was a brave act under Sonny Abacha's last month for these people to step forward and demand that he not remain in power. And this group is now transitioning into a larger political party, and they are going to be fielding a candidate in the February 27th election. That's the G34. But this past weekend, I went down to Port Harcourt, which is the heart of oil country. It's in the southern part of Nigeria. And this is a place, some of the poorest areas of Nigeria are here, believe it or not, in this oil-rich land. And here, the Democratic Alternative was having their national convention. The Democratic Alternative, a progressive grouping of people that began a few years ago. And there they battled for 2 days over whether to participate in the so-called democratic transition. And ultimately, they decided to postpone the convention for another month because they could not decide, many in the group saying it would be an outrage to support this transition that is being run by a military regime. And so a new political party was formed out of that one. But as you can see, there is a tremendous amount of political organizing that's taking place.
Now, those who oppose participating in the process that's called transition, this electoral process defined, determined by the military rulers, what do they suggest would be an appropriate alternative? They talk about democratic alternative. What would that be?
They are demanding a sovereign national conference. I've heard this from Nigerians outside of Nigeria. There are thousands of Nigerians who are in exile in the United States and in Europe. And I've heard it throughout, particularly the south of Nigeria. They're demanding a conference where all groups would be represented, all ethnic groups, particularly the minority groups that have very little power in this country and are the poorest. We're talking about the fourth largest group, the Ijaw, that take up a large part of the south and the oil-rich region. The Ogoni, for example, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I had the incredible opportunity this weekend to visit Ogoni land and to visit the family of Ken Sarawiwa. But these are the minority groups that have not had a say in Nigerian politics for this 38 years, particularly during the military regimes. And they are demanding that before there be an election, there has to be a restructuring of Nigerian government, that there has to be a federalism that is constructed in this country, sort of along the lines, I think it's fair to say, of the way the United States is set up, where states have power. And that way, if you have states having power and you have militaries that are part of those states, you could break the centralized power of the military that has led from coup to coup, that is the history of this country. So they are saying, before any kind of election that can take place, there must be a sovereign national conference where the entire country can decide their future, and that should not include the military.
Well, let's talk about the power of corporations. While Tuesday's announcement focuses attention on the electoral process and the end of military rule, so-called, and the dates for elections, you're talking about opponents of that transition process who want to see a state structuring, partly, I suppose, to restructure the tools of power and the institutions of power. Power, though, extends beyond the electoral system to the corporate system. What's happening on that front?
Well, it's very important when talking about the landscape of Nigeria to talk about it in that larger corporate context. I understand that there was a piece in the New York Times this weekend talking about Nigeria and its poverty, and you cannot talk about that without talking about the multinational corporations that have been involved with this country since its independence from Britain in 1960. We're talking about Shell. We're talking about the U.S. multinational corporations, Mobil, Chevron, Texaco. Shell here producing more about half of the oil of this country. Mobil around 22%, Chevron around 20%. What does that mean? It means that these multinational corporations are providing the lifeblood for these successive military regimes. They provide 96% of Nigeria's foreign exchange. 80% of the revenue for these military regimes comes from oil. And so if we're going to look at the strength of the military regime, we have to look at who's providing the fuel for those regimes, and it is the multinational corporations.
You said that you had just returned from Ogoniland, where you visited the family of Ken Sarawiwa. In the next 3 minutes that we have remaining, tell us a little bit about that visit.
Well, it was truly incredible. I actually went there on Monday, and it's really hard to describe. We went into Ogoniland. It's a highly militarized area, though not as militarized as it was when Ken Sarawiwa was alive. You have soldiers at military checkpoints along the way, as well as police, and many of them in the bush that you can't see. When we got to Ken's village, Bane Kanela, this was a village of incredibly impoverished people, a kind of poverty that even Nigerians from other parts of Nigeria are shocked at when they go. We traveled with a Nigerian journalist who just said he hadn't seen anything like this before. When we got to Ken's village, we went to his family's house, and hundreds of Ogoni came out to greet us and to sing their song of strength and power, to sing about their plight, which continues today. Ken's father is 90 years old. His mother cried when she spoke, as did his father. And they talked about how proud they were of their son and the fact that he didn't speak about himself. He spoke about the Ogoni people and their plight, this people that sit on perhaps some of the richest resource land in the world today and yet don't have any kind of sustained electricity, potable water, enjoy any of the resources that they are providing to the rest of their nation and to the world. More than half of the oil of Nigeria comes to the United States. Many people have heard about Ken Sarawiwa's battle, his leadership of the Ogoni people, and the Ogoni people remember him. They are highly conscious of what he represents and highly conscious of what Shell has done to their land. They forced out Shell, but that doesn't mean that they forced out Shell before Shell devastated this area. And one of the things that we were doing throughout this weekend as we traveled through the Niger Delta was documenting the communities of resistance, because the fact is this is not just a story of misery and poverty. It's a story of communities fighting back. It's absolutely incredible, though they certainly get no coverage in the international press. Almost every week you have communities who are fighting against Chevron, communities fighting against Mobil, against the Italian oil company AGIP. Just this past week, they closed down the AGIP headquarters. They prevented people from coming in and out, demanding that a community right next to those headquarters in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, that they be provided with, and they're just asking for minimal things, generators, that they be provided with water. But they are taking power into their own hands right now, and that's what's so amazing. We also went into a community where there were a lot of angry youth. These were communities we can only get to by boat because there are no roads, because this is a military dictatorship that cooperates with the oil multinational corporations that basically siphon the money out of these communities, siphon the resources out of the communities, and leave dead water, dead land, land where they can't grow their cassava, can't grow their yams, and can't fish, which is their basic subsistence livelihood. And we saw these youth had five Shell boats. They had taken them from oil flow stations of Shell throughout the Niger Delta, and they said they would not return them until Shell met some of their demands. And this is a story we are confronting over and over again throughout the Niger Delta. People saying they will fight back. If the military regime will not fight for them and simply fight against them and provide the soldiers and police to these multinational corporations to fight them, then they're going to take this into their own hands, and they're going to take control of their communities. We'll see how it turns out, but the fact is resistance is strong in the Niger Delta.
We're going to hear more stories when you get back, Amy Goodman. Pleasant as it has been to sit in for you, I cannot wait till you're back here at Democracy Now! To bring us some of the voices and the sounds of the places that you've been. We will hear back from you again soon before your visit is over. But thank you for being with us here on Democracy Now! We will talk to you again in the next few days, I hope. Good luck.
Well, thanks very much, Laura.
You're listening to Whom Else? Pacifica Radio's Amy Goodman. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay tuned, we'll be back with you in 60 seconds.
Vuno dina mo pusle awe do kaga chena suwe do chenga do we vuno dina mo pusle awe yeah yangogo mama joni bana yama yangogo yeah yangogo mama joni bana yama yangogo yeah yangogo mevu Ayangogo za dong wondong Okanga mongani mote ndong Amongani mote wuguru Ndongi borana za lewoyo Ayongani mormutamzi
You're listening to Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders. From Nigeria to Indonesia, where the struggle, you could say, is related, post-Suharto, as post-Sani Abacha, are people about to realize their dreams of a participatory democracy or see just a democratic face painted on the same old military machine? This week, the Indonesian military discharged a general infamous even in the brutal Suharto regime, Lieutenant General Prabowo Subianto, the former chief of the special forces known as Kopassus, who is also the son-in-law of deposed dictator Suharto, has been charged this week with kidnapping and torturing political dissidents. In announcing Prabowo's discharge, the armed forces chief, General Wiranto, said Prabowo could face a court-martial as more evidence emerges about the abduction of more than two dozen political dissidents earlier this year. At least 14 are missing and feared dead. But human rights groups say General Prabowo is implicated in countless other acts of brutality too, including the riots, arsons and rapes last May that precipitated Suharto's downfall, and the atrocities carried out during his leadership of Kopassus. Kopassus, you'll remember, was revealed as being the recipient of U.S. funds and training. Prabowo himself received training in Fort Benning, Georgia. The announcement then was criticized for not going far enough by a group representing the families of the missing dissidents and others. And at the same time, some are wary that the focus on one individual's culpability will work to distract from the number one demand of pro-democracy activists, which is for fundamental institutional change. We have with us here in the studio of Democracy Now! Edwin Gozal, the international representative of the People's Democratic Party, or PRD, and a member of Students in Solidarity for Democracy in Indonesia. The PRD was a leading opponent of the dictatorship of Suharto. It's been particularly active in student, peasant, and labor struggles, and in supporting self-determination for East Timor. A court recently overturned a government ban on the PRD, and the government said it wouldn't appeal. However, nine PRD leaders, including its head, continue to serve prison sentences of up to 13 years for subversion. Well, Edwin, welcome to Democracy Now!
Okay, thank you.
How did you greet this news that Prabowo Subianto is to be discharged?
Well, this indicate now that there's a certain democratic space in Indonesia where the army, the ABRI in Indonesia, is being put in the corner that by the mass escalation and mass protests in the last 6 months. So now that we realize that, I mean, ABRI, Indonesian Armed Forces, they could not do the same thing, the same repression that they did in the past with the Indonesian opposition movement. But we still need to find that what's the plan from the ABRI itself. If General Prabowo really taken to the court-martial, I think it's a small step forward. But if he just being sacked from his position, he lost his position, I think it will not indicate that they are the Indonesian army that will have that commitment to impose the democracy in Indonesia.
Do you agree with those who fear that this could be a distraction from the question of larger political change, valuable though, of course, it might be, to dismiss a single culpable individual?
Well, the problem is today, I think that General Prabowo is being scapegoated that by his rival, that General Wiranto. Then I think that army tried to describe that General Prabowo was an evil and Kopassus unit as an evil. But I think that it's ridiculous because that General Wiranto, also the authoritarian general, they are the same army being trained
as chief.
Professional killer in Indonesia, and both of them have relationship with the Pentagon, And I think that in this way, I think they just want to make themselves better. They realize that they need to make compromise, and then General Prabowo and his units being sacrificed under this atmosphere.
Tell us about your organization, the PRD. Am I right in thinking that you still have several leaders in jail, although the organization now is legal? Is that right?
Yeah, how can that be? It's right that just 2 weeks ago that the lower court decided to unban the PRD. Although I think that mostly because of legal reasons, not mainly because of political reasons.
So why do the leaders still stay in jail? There were some freed, right?
Yeah, there were some freed, but they almost finished their sentence also. That's the reason, I think. And I think there's still, because with conditional release, and still 8 of leader of the PRD remain in prisons now, and there's no indication there will be released soon. So I think it's indicate that this regime still want to keep, I think, that the PRD and try to eliminate and put PRD the sideline. In the same times, I think that 3 PRD members now still disappear from the 14 people who disappeared until today.
Who is the PRD? What kind of people make up the membership, and what are your goals and ideals?
Yeah, well, that PRD is the new political party who just entering political arena in the last 4 years. Most of us are young workers and young students and less than 30 years old. And we, the young generation of Indonesia who has an idea that of the multi-party democracy and the welfare economic system in Indonesia. So that's why we fight that against dictatorship in Indonesia. And we think that also that we should set up the pro-people governments. And that's, I think, that's a short description for me about the about the PRD. And that's why also that we support the self-determination for East Timor.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Edwin Gozal, the international representative of the PRD, the People's Democratic Party, and a member of Students in Solidarity for Democracy in Indonesia. Pro-people democracy, that's a term I hope we can repeat before the program is over. But first, I want to ask you how you, as a law student, became involved in all of this.
Well, surely this is a long story.
Give us a short version.
Yeah, short version instead. I'm Indonesian Chinese. That I grew up in a Chinese family. My grandfather came from mainland of China that many years ago. And during my childhood and I was teenager, I found that some discrimination from the governments towards the Chinese in Indonesia.
What kind of form does that take? We say discrimination often. We have no idea really what that means.
Yeah, that there's unofficial banning on the Chinese New Year. And then in your own ID, in your passport, you will find that the initial that they will identify you are a Chinese, and you are in court. I mean that in unofficial being pushed to change your names, you cannot have a Chinese name, and then any kind of Chinese culture that unofficially is being prohibited by the government, just kind of issue. And in some area, it is hard for you also to going there and participate. Like you are Chinese, you cannot go to military academy. I don't want to go there, but also that you could not. It's hard for you to go into a public university or something like that.
I know it's unfair to ask you to do this in a nutshell, but to give our listeners some sense of why this antagonism towards the Chinese in Indonesia.
Well, I think this antagonism is this repression. I think is only small part of the oppression of the Indonesian people. I think that this cultural oppression, also that political operations, also that directed against another ethnic. I think that what happened in the Chinese community, I think the same thing also happened with East Timorese people and other ethnic group, indigenous people in Indonesia. But in Chinese, it's become the powerful issue because Chinese is a small, tiny minority group, and most of them are probably involved in the economic sector because they don't have any chance to get involved in the political arena or another arena. Non-economic arena, so it creates also the social divisions among the society between Chinese and non-Chinese, and it's create the chance for the governments, I think, to provoke and then create the stigma of the anti-Chinese movement in Asia, and the medicine, I think, they want to change the anger of the people in different way, directed against the Chinese and not directed against the government. If they can convert it that the anger that not against the government, against the Chinese small, tiny minority groups, it also is good for them.
So a sort of lazy comparison might be to the Jews in Europe who were both vilified and discriminated against and used as a scapegoat in times of popular unrest.
Yeah, similar. In some way, it'd be similar.
So I interrupted your story of how you got involved.
Yeah.
Clearly coming from an ethnic Chinese background, yeah. And you're going into the university, you became a lawyer, I would assume, to fight discrimination, to do good things and to stop bad things. How did you get involved in a political movement for radical change in Indonesia?
Well, that after I have an idea that to get involved, I think that to fight for that against injustice in Indonesia. That at the time that I think 5 years ago, 4 years ago, that I began involved in the students' activity in my campus. That also during the circumstances in my campus, there's a big student protest. That for the first time I joined the student movement in my campus when I joined Student in Solidarity for Democracy in Indonesia. And then after being radicalized during that year, also until I joined PRD.
Tell us a bit about your vision for the future. As we kind of framed this discussion and heard the report from Nigeria, what we're talking about are people who are trying to put in place, perhaps, as you put it, a pro-people democracy in a place where there has been a military dictatorship. What do you see in the way of a way forward, the development of that pro-people democracy? How would it happen? What do you want to see occur?
Well, that if we look at, I think that's the comparisons with the experience that in some country or Nigeria. I just want to look at what happened in Philippines. I think post Marcos period, we found that there's a democratic space now. The dictatorship is gone. There's a multi-party system there, but in fact, I think that the ruling class that still that control the governments and the people who sacrificed a lot during the struggle against Marcos didn't get anything. I think that, yeah, they can have that. The former movie star become president, but I don't think that Arap Estrada is really pro-people's president. And I think in Indonesia that we don't want to kind of thing. I mean that we won't fight for the democracy in Indonesia when there's a system of multi-party democracy, when every political party can grow up in the based on their different political outlook, but also I think people itself also really have control with that, and also people have an idea how they can decide with their own future and then to decide that what they want. And I think that this I think we should find that the way that how the people will participate in different kind of organization or become the decision maker for their own future.
Well, then I'll ask you the same question I asked Amy about corporate power. We're talking about power structures, and so far we've talked about parties, dictatorships, presidencies, armed members of the armed forces. What about that part of power that's in the hands of corporations? What do you see as a pro-people's way of dealing with international capital?
Well, today, Indonesia is the fourth largest country in the world in the populations. Now I think it's being controlled also by some giant business company, but US company and Japan corporation and European Union corporations.
So that's also a similar situation in the Philippines where international corporations are.
And I think that in the future for us that there's no problem. We still need to build cooperation with them. But of course in different way with the atmosphere today, I think that the people should also have that the right that to have control with the assets in that kind of company, and then we have also that the benefit and the profit from the company should be channeled and distributed to the people also, and also the kind of transfer of technology. I think technology could not only be monopolized by that corporation and it should be transferred also to the people in Indonesia. I mean it's that kind of thing, and I mean like. For instance, that Freeport, McMoran, Louisiana-based company, then now that control the giant mining company, the gold mining company in West Papua, they only give the share only the 1% from the profit, I think, to the indigenous people in that area. And they said, oh, 1% is too much for you. That's what they said. But I think 1% is not enough for the people, indigenous people, around the area in the mining area.
But that is the very point that they would raise with you. They would say, well, before you didn't have that 1%. Now you have that 1%. Lucky for you.
Yeah, but I mean, what did they sacrifice in the last 32 years is not enough for only 1% from the profit. And how many percent? It's not only from the 99% that they get. I think they can achieve a lot of gain from that. I think that they build their own empire in U.S., but the Indian people are still suffering.
Tell us a little bit more about what is happening now in Indonesia. What are the most dramatic developments in the last few days that could give us a picture of how things are moving there? I understand there were, in the Aceh region, some mass graves discovered. Tell us a bit more about that, if you have any information pertaining to that situation.
Well, now I think the situation is that more and more people, I think, that are willing to challenge the governments and demanding their rights and express their demand in different way, like what they did in Aceh and different kind of area. They discovered a mass grave and the widow in some village also that they formed the Association of the Widow and then demanding their rights with against the political violence of the ABRI that in the past. And in some area in Asia, I think there's already more than 400 head of the village is being pushed to withdraw from their positions by the people in the countryside in different way they express their demand. And some governor being pushed to resign also. Now, I think there's a lot of spontaneous action now in different way. But the problem is they're very disorganized and discoordinated. And the civil servants and the government official, I think, they don't have any experience to handle, to deal with these conditions. When the people confront the governor and say, you kill Mr. So-and-so and during this time, you should take responsibility, they're very shocked with the situation. I think that's the situation now. So from the invalid people now, I think, until the attendant of Garuda, in a different way, they're willing to express, have the protest with their demand. I think they're all right being robbed by the government.
And I hate to have squeezed this into our last minute, but U.S. relations with Indonesia, what's changed?
Well, I think there's no change. I think that now that U.S. government seems that very keen to support Habibie, their position seems that, Suharto is gone now, everything is all right. And that's why William Cohen came to Indonesia around 2 weeks ago and then tried to establish the military training with the Indonesian military. And it seems General Wiranto is very keen also to accept that proposal. I think that there's no big difference in terms of U.S. foreign policy now.
That's Edwin Gozal, the international representative of the People's Democratic Party, the PRD, a member of the Students in Solidarity for Democracy in Indonesia, a leading opponent of the dictatorship of Suharto and an activist with people's struggles in support of self-determination in Indonesia and East Timor. Thanks very much, Edwin Gozal, for being here on Democracy Now! You are listening to, where else? Pacifica Radio, Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. If you want to contact the program, you call 212-209-2999. That's our comment line, 212-209-2999. And for a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, call 1-800-735-2030. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you want to reach us via email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org. You can hear us on the web, too, at www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee Soo Koo and Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Michelle Garcia is our web...